Gloria from U2's Under Blood Red Sky album, recorded live in Denver, Colorado, June the 5th, 1983. Welcome to U2 in their own words. My name's Tony Michael Edis, and for the next hour, you'll hear Adam Clayton and The Edge talking to me about the development of the band from their inception in Dublin in 1978 to the present day. U2's Under Blood Red Sky album entered the UK album chart at number 2, separating Duran Duran from Culture Club at the top of that chart. All of a sudden, Britain was aware of U2's importance as a major act, their previous album, War, having entered the UK album chart at number 1 and achieving top 10 status in America, the largest record market in the world. Their latest album, The Unforgettable Fire, a masterpiece of contemporary music, charted, as expected, at number 1. The four school friends from Dublin had finally arrived. For the next hour, enjoy U2 talking about their career and plans for the future, and rest assured, by this time next year, I doubt there'll be a greater act on earth. When the band performed their 2 sell-out concerts at the Manchester Apollo in November, I had the privilege of talking to The Edge and Adam Clayton. And first of all, I asked Adam if it was likely we'd ever see the band at the Apollo again.
At this point, it's difficult to say whether we would come back and do another Apollo. Certainly not on this particular world tour.
With the way the band's progressed and everything, and here we are sort of 5 years on from the time I saw you play the Polytechnic, for instance, and I was there in that room that Bono refers to where there were 9 people there. I was proud to say I was one of them. Would be a bit of an understatement to say you've come a long way since then, but I mean, it is actually a changed U2 now, isn't it, Edge, with the fact that everything is reliant on the total production and the sheer quality of the stage show that you're putting together. It's not relying so much on Bono climbing PA stacks nowadays, etc., is it?
Yeah, there's a certain finesse that we've developed over the last 12 months. And some would say it's long overdue. You know, we've survived for long enough, I think, on just vibe, you know. I always remember watching Wire Heat in their early days, and it seemed to me that they would construct situations like breakdowns of amplifiers and PAs just so Wiley could get on the microphone and abuse the audience and rap with the crowd for a few minutes. And that was great, you know, that works fantastically in a club or a small theatre. But when you start playing large places and your show must project to the very back of the hall, then I think you got to take it a bit more seriously and be a bit more, quote, professional about the whole thing. And we've become aware of this first in the States, where we started doing larger venues about 12 months ago. And with this record, things have just started really coming together and developing to in a direction that we, up till now, really haven't really considered.
You've, like we say, you've attracted a massive following, and you seem to have, a lot of the fans that were with you in the early days have stuck with you, and there's a huge amount of people that have got into U2, I think, since the Unforgettable Fire. How did, briefly, Adam, how did it all work out with Eno? Was it a huge success?
Musically, it was certainly an interesting development, and at the time it was exactly the right direction for the band to go. So I think in answer to that question, yes. In terms of how people see the records, I can't really comment because I haven't really had a chance to talk to any of the audience who come to the shows to sort of see what they get out of it, because I'm probably too close to it. But I think it was definitely a good move to make.
It's important to stress, I think, the fact that you knew exactly what you wanted when you approached Eno, wasn't it, in the first place, Edge?
Yeah, that's true. For the first time, we actually had some of the songs already written, and that, in a way, was one of the things that affected our choice of producer. Had the song been more American or something, we may have gone with someone else. But it seemed to us at the time that they really had a very overt European perspective, and we wanted somebody, some producer that could enhance that. And Eno just seemed like a perfect choice. As it turned out, he was more perfect even than we envisaged originally.
Of course, everybody and everyone seems to be wanting Brian Eno to produce them now. Was it a difficult decision for him to make, or did he take to you straight away?
I think Brian is the kind of person who makes decisions very much on impulse. I mean, he'll spend a lot of time worrying about it and thinking about it, but when it actually comes down to the decision, he has no difficulty making it. And, well, I mean, it's not really my place to say whether he made the decision easily, but I think when he spoke to the band, because he basically wasn't interested in rock music, but when he spoke to us and realised that we weren't particularly interested in standard rock music, and he realised that we wanted to continue with our sort of innovative forays into the depths of traditional 12-bar or whatever, he saw what we were up to and said, yeah, I'd like to be involved in that. And I think also that the kind of soul roots, if you like, of the band, which is not a 60s soul, it's an 80s kind of soul, I think that appealed to him as well.
You two, in their own words, Adam Clayton and The Edge, and they'll be back in a moment.
You have been on the road since the end of August, haven't you? How long are you going to be touring to promote this latest record, The Unforgettable Fire?
We go back in the spring, and we probably will be there for about 2 or 3 months, which is how long it takes to get to all the major centres in North America. From there, I think we'll probably come home, maybe do 1 or 2 festivals, and then just leave it at that. I think everyone in the group is anxious to get back into the studio with someone, maybe Brian again, maybe Danny Lanois, and produce another LP.
I was going to ask you about that, if you were going to use Eno again, or you were going to move on and experiment, because I think people generally have looked upon the album quite favourably, people that weren't necessarily into your previous efforts, and everyone's respected the fact that you could have made another guitar album, but you've attempted something different.
Well, I think it's definitely early days to actually decide where the particular path we've taken is going to lead us to. But certainly at this stage, the band has taken a branch off, maybe a bit left of or right of the field, whichever way you choose to look at it. And I think we'll continue with that. Whether or not we could do another record with Brian and Danny, it's too early to say. It depends on what songs we write.
Was it an easy record to make, Edge? Did you have a lot of trouble sitting down actually writing for The Unforgettable Fire? Because it was another phase in a totally different band, wasn't it?
Well, we started out with some songs which we finished to the best of our own abilities. Then Brian and Danny arrived. I suppose we had 15 pieces before they arrived. None of them really finished, but they were certainly well on the way. Instead of finishing those 15, we wrote another 15. So immediately, instead of having the usual kind of LP's worth of material plus 2 or 3, which, you know, we weren't sure about, we had double the amount of stuff we needed. Mainly these were just ideas that hadn't really been developed. So the record immediately changed in identity from what we had envisaged at first. And because of that, I think we weren't really quite sure quite where it was going to end up. That was a really positive thing, I think, in many ways. But because of that, I think it took us a lot longer to finish the songs, to get the finished melodies and lyrics and finished performances of the voice and final takes done. So in that respect, the fact that it did take us 3 months to finish meant that it has been and was a very difficult record to finally, you know, knock on the head. But it was an intensely gratifying session, you know. It was very inspiring, very challenging. And it seemed like, you know, a couple of weeks, you know, when you look back on it, it really doesn't seem like it was 3 months at all.
I personally feel that with The Unforgettable Fire, that you've got an extra instrument in there with Bono's voice, because I don't think ever has his voice sounded so powerful as on this latest record.
Well, when we met with Brian originally, that was really one of the cornerstones to the production that we wanted to hone in on, which was to make Bono's voice kind of live and soar a bit in a way that it hadn't done before. And we achieved this, in fact, funnily enough, by going back to an old valve microphone, which was similar to the type of microphone that, say, somebody like Presley would have recorded with. And at the end of the day, it really did come down to finding the right microphone for his voice. and then it just happened. You know, you didn't have to work on it at all. So it just proves that transistors aren't so good these days.
Pride. I think it'd be fair to say that it is an obvious single, isn't it, to be taken from the album. But you've never been a band edge concerned with writing hit singles, have you? I mean, if there's a track on the album or whatever that happens to be commercial, you've never really worried, have you?
No, our emphasis has always been on the LPs, on creating an album of material that has some sort of ebb and flow and works as a collection of pieces. With Pride, I think the essence of the song is very simple, and that's probably why it makes sense as a 45. The original structure was a lot more complex, and it was Eno's influence, I think, that led us to cut it down, to strip it down to the bare essentials of the piece. And in so doing, I think we produced probably one of our only true single releases. So, I mean, it wasn't envisaged originally as a 45, but it just became obvious, you know, when we mixed it, that it was actually a song that could go very, very far in the charts.
The album title, Adam, The Unforgettable Fire, any particular reason?
Well, it's, as usual, it's not a simple answer. It's a sort of blanket expression. Firstly, The Unforgettable Fire is an exhibition of, well, Japanese national treasures, which were sort of sketches that people made from their memories who were involved in the two bombs that went off in Japan. And it was basically, because there were no cameras or anything, it was the victims put down their thoughts and feelings, and I mean, very moving, but I think important that people should know about it, because if there's any way that you can prevent the same thing happening again, it's by not forgetting that that bomb did go off and it did destroy the Japanese race. Fortunately, they've recovered at this point. Also, it refers to the unforgettable fire of a man like Martin Luther King and Presley, these sort of big figures of almost American folklore at this point. And I think there's a more sinister connotation with the fire of, say, alcohol and heroin as well. So I think it covers all those sort of three areas, and there are clues all the way through the album as to which category each song sort of falls into.
It's actually my favourite track on the record at the moment. I tend to change my opinion from week to week, but just at the moment that is it. It's a song that started its life quite a while ago as just a little piano piece, and developed from there to the track that's on the record. We demoed it before Brian and Danny arrived. And the nice thing about that song is that the essential musical qualities that it had as a piano piece and as a demo are still there as a final track on the record. But it's just stated in a far stronger, more confident way. It's one of the nicest pieces I think we've ever done as a band.
U2, in their own words. Back in a second with more from Adam Clayton and The Edge.
The critics' reviews of the album were quite favourable, considering you must think it is backlash time, and then it's quite astonishing to see this week the savage attack you've received from the music papers. I mean, NME quote you as the worst band in the world. Well, I and several hundred thousand other people in this country would beg to differ.
Well, I'll tell you what I'd like to do. I think it would be very interesting to see what would happen to NME if it was reviewed every week in another paper or on a radio show in the way that they treat bands in their pages. I think that's the problem with something like the NME, is that there is no watchdog keeping an eye on it and making it toe the line. It's, you know, it's all fairly trivial. I think people have largely given up reading those sort of papers anyway, because they're fed up with the sort of cancer that they spread.
Interesting to note that this same paper, Edge, heralded Boy as the finest debut album for 10 years.
Yeah, it's really funny how times change, you know, and policies change in the sub-editorial side of these sort of magazines. But I honestly believe that they're really cutting their own throats, because they're getting so cynical and so negative that it's honestly, it's penance reading them now. I never read those things anymore. Very few musicians that I know of read them, or if they do, it's just
in secret.
They just maybe pick one up every couple of months if there's something particularly that interests them. But really, who wants to pick up papers like that and read this sort of trash that they're putting out? It's just so depressing. That's the only word for it. You read it and you feel, my God, you know, what's this business all about? Let's just pack it in and open greengrocer's shops or something. It's just, you know, what more can you say?
They will, in fact, sell a few more copies by generating a reaction, because there's going to be a lot of people that are going to write in and call people like, I won't even mention his name, because why should we give him the fame? But by lashing into you the way that they have done, they'll create a name for themselves, much the same as an assassin would.
Well, life is very long. We can sit this one out. Since the early days in Dublin, we've had attacks of all types at various stages, and we've survived them all, so I think we'll sit this one out.
Right, we'll move on to play Bad from the album. Bad's an interesting title, Edge. Did you have much trouble thinking up a title like that?
It seemed actually quite an obvious one. In fact, it was so obvious that we questioned it originally. One of the early inspirations for that song was a certain repetitive quality that the Velvet Underground would have used in their early days. And the song, lyrically, was, I think, seemed to be dedicated to a friend of Bono's who was going through a very bad time with heroin. So the whole thing, I mean, that title suggested itself quite early on in the making of the song. So it was one of those working titles that we weren't sure about, and then when it came to the end of the record, we had to make a decision. And I think everyone was convinced that that was the title, really, and that nothing else could sum everything up quite so well.
I'm talking to Adam Clayton and The Edge from U2, and you just heard a track from the album that you'll all know, Bad. Are there any plans to take another single off the record, or would you take some time off and perhaps write another single?
Well, that's a decision we're going to have to make in the next week or so. We have a provisional plan to re-record a track from The Unforgettable Fire and rearrange it and present it in a different way, and that would be the only way we would put out another single. We wouldn't want to take another track off the album and sort of put it out. We'd like to, if we put something else out, we'd like it to be a bit different and a bit special.
It's not fair to still refer to you as a guitar band now, is it, Edge? I mean, you are progressing, and I think you will attract a lot more fans through this album. And, well, I say critics as opposed to reviewers, but generally it's been looked on quite favourably. Are you pleased?
Yeah, very pleased. When we first decided to ask Brian to produce, assuming that he was going to do it, we felt that it would be possibly a commercial failure of a record. I mean, Brian said himself, he said, look, if you want me to produce something commercial, I've never produced a commercial album in my life. And if you look back at his history, he's produced some very influential work, but nothing that has meant a commercial turning point in a band's career, quite the opposite. But we decided that at this stage in our career, that really wasn't what we were worried about. And the LP that we finally ended up with has just been way above my expectations in that respect. It's a record that displays the many abilities within the group to their best advantage. It's more of a representation of the band than any of the other records. It shows more of the contrast of the group with songs like Pride, the way that is so concise, so simple, and yet so strong, down to things like 4th of July, which is, well, the story of that track is myself and Adam were just playing together a few little figures in the castle where we were doing our basic recording, and we weren't even aware that it was being listened to but Brian was in the other room, the control room, and he just was listening to what we were doing, had a few treatments up, which he quite liked. And so he put the quarter-inch machine on. That's just the stereo machine. So it was like a live recording. So it went down, and then we decided to put it on the record. So, you know, it's total contrasts in this record. It's definitely my favourite of our LPs so far.
I'd be inclined to agree with that. With this album, Adam, and the fact that you have experimented and it has to some extent worked, I mean, you haven't been critically savage from the album reviews, it must give you the confidence to move on yet again.
Well, I think we now are in a position to take on the studio in a different way. I think the first three albums in many ways were made on the run, in that we were very much surviving on being a touring band because we hadn't got the hit singles. And with this record, we've found that we don't really have to look at material in terms of playing it live. We look at it in terms of pieces of music. So I think there is room to do a lot more next time we go into the studio, now that we have that freedom on our side.
Well, I'm delighted that you've found the time to talk to me today, fellas. I really do appreciate it, and I'm quite honoured. Can Britain expect to see you two in 1985, Edge?
It's difficult to say. We might be back for a small one-off show or something. Other than that, I think probably you'll be hearing about us back in the studio in 1985, and hopefully an album by early 1986.